being a collective was kind of a necessity because absolutely nobody is going to be able to afford to buy a gay club in downtown San Francisco at this time, let alone buy anything, a house, groceries, a coffee, a latte. Girl, you're going to have to take your bank account out to buy a latte.
Hey, streamers and dreamers, this is Otto Kent, and you're listening to The Week by Telecom Electronic Beats. It's Thursday, April 25th, and this is your weekly update on music, culture, and what's next. This week, we're talking about the group of friends who helped save the Stud, San Francisco's oldest queer bar and club, King Street Sounds, Black British Music at the British Library, Rico Wade, and celebrating the legacy of DJ Rashad. Iconic house label King Street Sounds is getting relaunched. So this one goes out to our dedicated house heads. If you've been anywhere near dance floors for the past 30 years, then you have heard at the very least a vocal chop from King Street Sounds. They put out artists like Carrie Chandler, Louis Vega, Alternate, Lil Lewis, and Joe Clausel. Need I say more? Now, the label is getting a second life thanks to Armada Music. Yes, that's the same Armada Music co-founded by the trance DJ Armin van Buuren, which might seem strange, but last year, Armada purchased all of King Street's catalog through what they are calling the world's first dance music investment platform, named the Beat Music Fund. Let's hope they do well by the name and keep things close to home. And speaking of things making a comeback, in this week's deep dive, we're talking about a very significant bar and club in San Francisco, The Stud. So last weekend in San Francisco, The Stud Bar and Club rose from the dead, so to speak. And this resurrection seems to be a running theme. The Stud is the city's oldest queer bar and club, opened with a country western theme in 1966 in the heart of the city's Leather District. And now they're back, and bigger than ever based on last weekend's grand reopening. Over the years, The Stud stayed a local favorite while becoming a magnet for international artists and DJs. One of my favorite nights there was doing the opening duties for Ben UFO. But one of the unique parts of the evolution of The Stud is that it is now not run by a single individual, but by a 17-person collective who bought it in 2016 to save the space from gentrification woes. It's an extremely rare case of a nightlife venue being collectively and cooperatively owned, especially in the US. Who are these 17 owners? They are the dancers and drinkers, the drag queens and kings who just refuse to let The Stud disappear. And with so many venues getting shut down because of high rents, The Stud reopening is a fabulous example to learn from. So this is where we're going today, so to speak, my old home of San Francisco. We invited Mark Bischke, one of the collective's founding members, to find out more about what lessons The Stud holds for a new generation of ravers and dancers. Marky, Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, there was a big party on the weekend.
There was. It was a little wild. We had anticipated the pent-up excitement over our return would explode, and boy, did it explode. Everyone from the Cockettes from the 1970s up through the latest cutting-edge social media phenom drag queens kind of strutted their stuff through our new space, and it was glorious.
I think that the theme of the night and the way that you guys organized the night for this grand reopening is a great way to introduce to listeners who might have never heard of The Stud what The Stud exactly is and its legacy. So do you want to give listeners a little rundown on this wild concept party?
So we decided to do a theme night where each hour of our opening paid tribute to a different era of The Stud. Kind of the eras corresponded to the decades The Stud had been open, but sometimes they overlapped. So this from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. was the 60s, 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. was the 70s, et cetera, through our club kid era, through our wild 90s era, through our 2010s, even when the collective took over and started transforming the space into something for the community. And it was crazy. We brought in DJs that played theme music. We had drag queens performing numbers from each of those eras. But what I found most interesting was it wasn't quite so literal. Everybody brought their own interpretation of each decade of the stud, and that really transcended like a boring history lesson. It really became something that was its own creature that paid tribute to so many decades of gay life in San Francisco and all the weirdness that had happened.
My introduction was, that's where you go to see the most outrageous drag. And if you're lucky, you were there the night that Lady Gaga performed. Which I was not. I was not lucky enough to be there, but then I just heard about it all weekend, about how there was this crazy lady that performed there that had this fun song. And then over the course of the next 6 years, everyone being like, oh, I was there, I was there.
Everyone turned out for that night, even if they weren't there.
Yeah, no, lies, lies upon lies upon lies. No one was there.
No one was there.
But yeah.
No. Oh, yeah, no, I love that night that you're talking about is T-Shack that for many, many years held it down for the particular San Francisco style of drag, which mixes punk rock, avant-garde, expressionism. You know, you're going to get wet, you're going to get bloody, you're going to run out in horror at many of the acts,
absolutely.
But also you're going to be moved and touched by the deep cuts and the dedication that people put into their numbers. And I think that's like such a wonderful representation of San Francisco that really, you know, it's kind of the anti-drag race kind of aesthetic of, you know, you're just going up there with a plastic bag and making magic.
definitely, you know, yes. Kind of there were a lot of plastic bag dressmakings. shout outs to David Glamamore. But Mark, do you remember your first night ever at the stud?
I do. And this is, it's interesting that you talk about it coming from a performance perspective because, you know, we've always balanced our dance music side with our performance side and tried to mix them as much as possible. But when I first landed in San Francisco, this is 1994, the stud was famous for its Monday night funk and hip hop nights, which were groundbreaking because this was one of the first places you could go a gay night and hear hip hop. You know, which coming from Detroit, that was so refreshing and wonderful to me. And so I could just suddenly be around people like myself who listened to music that wasn't so much mainstream gay at the time. You know, it wasn't the remixes. It wasn't the four on the floor. It was just a really nice laid back vibe, plus full of super hot boys. So that was fantastic, too. And yeah, so the stud was groundbreaking, not just in drag, but in introducing hip hop nights. Earlier, the stud was the first club in San Francisco to introduce house music nights. You know, we really had new wave nights. We played punk. The music side of us has always been really groundbreaking, especially in the context of what you think of as a mainstream gay club. So starting from the beginning when we were a country and western club.
Yeah, I mean, the history of the stud is also quite interesting from a activist and rule breaker side of the equation. One little tidbit, because I threw a nightclub at the old stud space for many years, and we would like uncover all of these weird secrets about the old space. And one of them was that it had an after hours license by running what they called a juice bar or a juice portion of the club, which was sanctioned to be open late because they registered it as a freaking church.
This is true.
So, you know, for Europeans who don't quite understand how evangelical nightlife in America can be, after hours licenses can be quite hard to come by in certain cities or in certain places in general. They're not that common. And the stud got around that by registering itself as a gay church.
Indeed. And it was called the Universal Life Chorale, which is the, you know, country and western themed church. And I would say a lot went on there besides juicing.
Yeehaw!
You know, we pay in the new space. We actually pay tribute to that. We have a separate room, a bar room called the Chorale Room, with the original Universal Life Chorale sign.
Yes.
Put up above the bar.
Amazing.
So we're really paying tribute. And hopefully we can match that energy energy with the old energy someday.
Oh, well, I know a couple of the 17 members who will definitely be able to match that energy. So let's get into it. Let's talk about the pretty impressive claim that the Stud is the only cooperatively run nightclub in America.
We are so excited to be really the only one, at least that we know, and nobody has stepped up to challenge us, is the only collectively run nightclub, you know, in the United States right now.
Well, as an American sitting in Europe as we speak, what is your understanding of collective or cooperatively run nightclubs across the world? I'm sure as a group, you guys have had to do some research on this.
Yeah, we definitely have looked around. I mean, we've taken inspiration from everything from Berlin's anarchist squats to some of the movement, civil rights movements that gave rise in the Black community and Brown community to businesses that were collectively run. San Francisco and California has a wonderful, deep history of co-ops and collectives. Even here in San Francisco, there's famous grocery stores.
Yeah, shout out to Rainbow Grocery.
Exactly. Famous bakeries that have been around for decades. You know, the hippie movement really gave rise here to the collective passion. And so we tapped right into that. We were very lucky to have that in our own backyard to talk to our elders about, to see how their business model worked, and to see, you know, how things changed over time. We wanted to make sure that this had longevity. And so we wanted to make sure that we could see how collectives and co-ops evolve with changing economic times, like being shut down by a pandemic suddenly, you know, and there were collectives from the days of AIDS that had to deal with those kind of things, you know, so we really look to our gay elders and our co-op elders to guide us on that.
So the clock is ticking for 10 years of this collective venture, which blows my mind. Why do you think that you guys are about to hit a 10-year milestone? What have you guys done to keep this going?
Well, I mean, one of the things is, first of all, we love each other very deeply. We are a family. And, you know, each of us brings our own strength to the collective. You know, like you said in the intro, there's dancers, there's drinkers, there's bartenders, there's promoters. You know, I work in the press, you know, in journalism. Other people work greasing political wheels because they're embedded in City Hall. So we kind of are a super friends kind of collective, an Avengers, if you will. And so that has really been the basis of our strength. But also we constantly check in with each other to see how we need to evolve and change as well. For instance, we started out as a strict cooperative, which in California means everybody has to do all of the jobs. Like you, if you're in the cooperative, you do all the work. But after about a year of us waking up 3 hours after a party to go clean toilets and floors, we decided, okay, we need to find a way to hire people to do this stuff. I mean, not that I'm above scrubbing a toilet, and sometimes I like that better than throwing a party, let me tell you.
Same.
We decided, you know, or we needed more bartenders, or we needed, once we expanded, or we needed more door people. So we changed our definition to a collective, which really means that we do all the decision making and we do all the consensus kind of work while we're able to hire people from the community to do these jobs.
Well, I had a very simple question for you, which is, when you've entered into a collective situation, let's say 17 roommates at the Stud, which is what it sounds like to me, are you able, how do you get out of that if you want to?
Well, I mean, to start at the very beginning, being a collective was kind of a necessity because absolutely nobody is going to be able to afford to buy a gay club in downtown San Francisco at this time, let alone buy anything, a house, groceries, a coffee, a latte. Girl, you're going to have to take your bank account out to buy a latte. So in San Francisco. So, you know, we all entered it knowing that we had to pool our money to make this work. So we all were dedicated from the very beginning because we were all connected to each other fiduciarily as well as emotionally and, you know, on this project. You know, it's you know, we're not a cult. We're not like, you cannot leave. We all all have different backgrounds and, you know, different political perspectives on things, although, of course, we tend towards the radical queer anarchists fun stuff. You know, it's just kind of a commitment that we've all been really willing to be in, you know, and we do have, you know, we do have bylaws like any other financial situation where, you know, if people want to leave, there are ways for people to leave. But we just love each other so much that we don't want to do it, especially when we have parties like last Saturday.
Yeah, it seems like obviously the payoff is great. And obviously the social interaction that comes with doing something that is meaningful for the community and has historical significance, but also makes you the leader of a really cool cult. Why not?
The stunt cult.
So realistically, I mean, when I started to go to the Stud, it all felt very fresh and new to me, but that was just because of my age. And as the Stud grows older, in a way, its audience seems to get younger. And I know that there are definitely some people who are involved in the collective who are in their late 20s, early 30s. How are you guys shaping what the Stud means to new young ravers and drag queens and queers?
Well, you know, I mean, that is a wonderful question. And while we were closed during the pandemic, I kind of panicked a little because the scene was changing so rapidly. I mean, in here in San Francisco, the rise of trans nightlife, you know, just like amazing trans DJs playing the hardest trance that you can imagine at outdoor raves on a mountain, to some of the drag kids who are like incorporating new technologies and what they do and just like coming up with these amazing immersive performances. The technology was changing in terms of sound and DJ equipment. You know, it was just kind of like, how are we going to open after 4 years and not seem like we got run over by the time truck, you know? So you know, that's one of the challenges we faced. And I think what we've been doing is gradually reaching out to different audiences and different performers that we think are fantastic and finding a way to build our scene around what they're doing and just staying open-minded and open-eared. Our first real party, our secret first real party, we invited a bunch of some of the best trans DJs that we have in the scene and invited the people that their scene that they had been building. And it was just an incredible night of banging trance all night. And I love the fact that someday in 50 or 60 more years, people are going to look back and say, oh, the first party, that was the first party at that new space.
Nice.
You know, so it's incredible. So we really just, you know, fortunately, all of us are, you know, music mavens and we keep our eye on the scene. But we just keep an open mind. It's so easy to be bitter when you're gay and old and, you know, queer and you don't like the younger kids.
I have no idea what you're talking about. But I did actually want to ask this question, which is, how do you hold space when you're trying to open a new space and it's so expensive and you're bringing fresh young blood and nightlife is always younger than ever and, you know, got to make TikToks this time around. How are you guys holding space and creating space for people who might have been patrons of the Stud for over 30 years?
Yeah, I mean, that is a fantastic question, both socially and economically, because a lot of the people who formulated the Stud don't have the money to stay in the city, let alone go to a $30 club night where you're paying $15 for drinks, which is basically what it is now for just a regular night out, not to mention your Uber and your outfit, etc. So, you know, we are dedicated to finding ways to subsidize staying affordable for everyone. The artists that are on the verge of being driven out constantly, our elders who don't have the money coming in that they used to, and everyone just struggling to hold on this city. So we just want to make sure that our priority is to stay accessible, affordable. You know, we're always going to have that $3 shot, you know, somewhere in there. I don't know what it is, but it's like you're going to have it.
So 17 people in the Stud Collective, how many of those people are DJs? All of them? A lot of them.
There's a lot of them. There's actually about five DJs. Okay.
Queens. How many performers?
I think we've got three drag queens.
Oh, okay, so the ratios are low.
Three drag queens. Yeah, you know.
But I'm sure listeners want to know who gets to pick, who DJs, who gets to perform. How do you keep all of that stuff in check? And have you guys created your own systems, or you built them based off of other people's systems that you found? How does the diva of a collective that's running club nights and drag nights stay in check with 17 people?
Yeah, we're lucky that we are very balanced, and we're also very honest with each other. So if we do not like what you are performing or DJing, we will tell each other, you know, all in the spirit of love and complicity. But yeah, so we basically just keep the conversation open. You know, we have 10 bartenders in the group. We have, you know, and it's just really a matter of just doing our own thing. Fortunately, we don't all play the same music. We don't all perform the same drag. You know, we're every different kind of gender, so we're coming from all different kinds of performance aspects when it comes to drag. So it's like, you know, it keeps itself in check magically.
Man, it is quite a relief for all 17 of you to finally say, we have a new home.
Oh my God, to be able to walk into our own bar and have a drink and not have to pay for it is the best feeling in the world.
Now, just don't lose the keys.
Thanks.
Congratulations on the new stud.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us, Marky. Now let's get into some more news that mattered this week. The British Library opens Beyond the Baseline, 500 years of Black British music. The brand spanking new exhibition claims to be the first of its kind anywhere in the world, combining archival footage, costumes, interactive displays, and music to highlight the incredible history of Black British music cultures. It was created in partnership with the Black Music Research Unit at the University of Westminster, and they collected over 200 exhibits touching on pretty much every genre and style imaginable. They are also planning a series of events featuring performances and talks with artists like Soul to Soul, Eddie Grant, who wrote Electric Avenue about the Brixton riots, DJ Paulette from the Hacienda, and more. So if you find yourself in London, def take some time to check this out. It'll be running for the next 12 months. Rico Wade, a hero of Atlanta hip-hop, dead at 52. Wade was a member of the songwriting and production trio Organized Noise alongside Ray Murray and Sleepy Brown. They were an essential force in shaping the sound of Southern hip-hop through their work on albums by artists such as Outkast and Goody Mob. And they were also part of the so-called Dungeon Family, a loose group of up-and-coming artists who recorded future hits, yes, you guessed it, legend has it, in the basement of Wade's mother's house in Atlanta. Wade and Organized Noise combine regional styles with a pop sensibility, cranking out hits like TLC's Waterfalls and Outkast's Player's Ball. The documentary, The Art of Organized Noise, goes into detail on all this and more, and I'll put a link for it in the show notes. Tech Life celebrates DJ Rashad. Rashad tragically passed away in 2014, just as his star was rising. The footwork pioneer co-founded the Tech Life label with DJ Spin and helped bring the genre from Chicago to the world. It is a sound and tempo that seems more relevant today than ever, but Tech Life has been tirelessly keeping his legacy alive. Now they're celebrating a 10th anniversary of Rashad's death with a series of memorial events. Four different parties are happening this weekend in London, New York, Hong Kong, and Chicago, with acts like DJ Spin, Scratcha DVA, DJ AC, DJ Haram, Traxman, and other people who are keeping the footwork fire burning. So that's all for the week this week. Thanks for listening. Next week, I'll be back with our second electronic beats conversation of the year. This time with Narciss, one of Berlin's new vanguard of techno artists repping color and the campier side of things. And I'm not lying when I say we could have talked for hours, so you know it's going to be worth a listen. The Week is a production by Telecom Electronic Beats and ACB Stories.